From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman talk about their collaborations. Schwartzman made his film debut in Rushmore, which was written and directed by Anderson. They're co-writers of the new film, The Darjeeling Limited. Anderson directed it, and Schwartzman plays one of three estranged brothers who reunite on a train trip across India that's intended to be a spiritual journey. The other two brothers are played by Adrian Brody and Owen Wilson. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new shows, Aliens in America and Pushing Daisies. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue featuring Lee Morgan at the age of 18. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, The Darjeeling Limited, is directed and co-written by my guest Wes Anderson, who also made the films The Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore. Rushmore launched the acting career of my other guest, Jason Schwartzman, who starred in that film as a prep school misfit. Schwartzman is a co-writer of The Darjeeling Limited, and he stars in it along with Owen Wilson and Adrian Brody. The film opened the New York Film Festival last week and opens in theaters Friday. The story is about three brothers who have not spoken to each other since their father died 1 year ago. Each of the brothers is lost and damaged in his own way. Wilson's character is physically damaged after a motorcycle accident. His face is in bandages through the film. Watching the character, you can't help think about Wilson's recent suicide attempt. Wilson plays the oldest of the brothers. He summons his two brothers to India and arranges for the three of them to take a train trip together on the Darjeeling Limited. Here's a scene just after the brothers meet on the train. Wilson's character is welcoming his two younger brothers and explaining what the trip is all about.
I want to start by thank you both for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're the two most important people in the world to me. I've never said that before, but it's true. And I want you both to know it. I love you, Peter.
Thank you.
I love you, Jack.
I love you, too.
How did it get to this? Why haven't we spoken in a year? Let's make an agreement.
Okay. What?
A, I want us to become brothers again like we used to be, and for us to find ourselves and bond with each other. Can we agree to that?
Okay. Yeah.
B, I want us to make this trip a spiritual journey where each of us seek the unknown and we learn about it. Can we agree to that?
Sure. I guess so.
C, I want us to be completely open and say yes to everything, even if it's shocking and painful. Can we agree to that? Now, I had Brendan make us an itinerary.
Who's Brendan?
My new assistant. He's going to place an updated schedule under our doors every morning of all the spiritual places and temples that we need to see, and expedite hotels and transportation and everything.
How's he going to do that?
I had him bring a printer and a laminating machine.
Where is he?
Well, it actually doesn't matter. He's in a different compartment on another part of the train. But we never see him. Ever. That's more or less it. Three, please. Does that sound okay to you?
Sounds good, sure.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Do you have any questions?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
What happened to your face?
Wes Anderson, Jason Schwartzman, welcome to Fresh Air. Wes, why did you want to do a movie about three brothers making... or trying to make a spiritual quest through India?
Well, my first thought with this movie was to make a movie in India, which was inspired really by movies that I loved that were set in India, or in particular the films of Satyajit Ray. But for me, where the project really started was when I had the idea to work with Jason Schwartzman and Jason's cousin, my friend Roman Coppola, on the script. When the three of us got together and we took our own journey through India, traveling in a train around Rajasthan and going up to the Himalayas, that became the sort of subject matter for the film.
What struck you both most about the differences between the trains in India that you were riding and, say, Amtrak?
Well, you know, the train it's funny because I like to ride trains. So I've traveled on trains in lots of different countries. And the train in the movie, we used one of the kind of standard trains that we rented from the government, from the Ministry of Trains in India. But we sort of made it into a combination of all the trains all over the world that I've traveled on. So the train in the movie is sort of an imaginary version of an Indian train. It's decorated by artisans that we met there, and it's sort of all things we discovered in India, but the design of it kind of combines things from all over the world.
Wes Anderson, one of the things I really love about your movies is that you make movies that are comedies, but about people who are damaged or lost. As the three brothers are in your new movie. And I guess this is a pretty broad question, but can you talk about making comedies about people who are a little bit broken?
You know, I don't have any interest in telling stories about very happy, well-adjusted people. It doesn't seem that appealing to me. And the damaged people usually seem funnier and also more sympathetic. So that's maybe where, right? And also, in the case of a movie like this, we wanted this movie to be as personal as it could possibly be. That was sort of our credo while we were writing it together. Anytime we needed an answer for what happens next in the story or how does the character respond, we tried to just say, well, what has happened to you? Mm-hmm. And I guess when we did that, they end up being very damaged characters.
That's
what. Can you each tell me a story that came out of your lives and ended up in the film?
I can think of some right off the bat, but I don't want to say them on
whoa,
the air.
Whoa.
I would say, for instance, in the case of the character that Jason plays, Jack is his character's name, his character has sort of arrived in India having just come out of a sort of doomed romance that he's still kind of reeling from. And I think, that in particular, I think both of us relate to that character.
Definitely.
Yeah.
The three brothers are on camera at the same time during a lot of the movie, and they're each reacting differently to what's going on around them. So often there's like three brothers, their faces are on camera, it's close up on their faces, and they each have a different facial reaction to what's happening. So I'd like, Wes, for you first to talk about framing that, and then Jason, for you to talk about knowing that so much of the movie is taking place on your face.
Mm-hmm.
Wes, your turn.
Yes. Well, the way we shot most of this movie, and I think the way I usually like to sort of start when we're approaching a scene is I'd rather figure out how can we do it without the cutting. It's more fun for me to do it that way, and also it lets the actors play the scene all the way through. And what you end up with is usually something where you can kind of where it feels like they're really doing it. They're really playing the scene like they're on a stage or like it's in real life. One or the other, or some mixture of those things. I think the end result is that they're often kind of, you know, the control you lose when you do that is you can't pick a moment from this close up and a moment from that close up. You've got to just choose a take of the whole scene. And it often kind of has a slightly more homemade feeling. And anyway, that's the way I like to do it. And so you end up, but in the case of this movie, you often see all three of them together in the shot, and they're each doing their own thing. They're making their contribution that, I just stand back and watch.
Jason, yeah. Can you talk about knowing how much of the movie is about close-ups of your face along with the two actors playing your brother?
Well, I will say one thing, and I don't know if this answers your question or not, but I found that most of the experiences that were happening to the characters in the movie felt or seemed almost identical to the ones we were having as real people there at the time, live. So these are three brothers, three American brothers in an exotic country in India, and so were we, three actors in an exotic country in India. And so a lot of the times it was fun for me, I suppose, because when I would look up at Adrian and smile, not only am I thinking, you know, what the character's thinking and going, wow, can't believe this, I'm also feeling that way as a person. Wow, I'm here. We're here. Can you believe we're here together? And all of us, I think, are reacting in a very live, real way. And that's what I can say about having a close-up on my face. It's just that's the way it always felt real to me to have that the camera there capturing us, because we really were there having those experiences. I know that's a kind of a vague or weird answer, but that was my gut reaction to how to answer your question. But I also will say that it was a very small train compartment, just to add what Wes was saying, and it having all three brothers in the shot seemed like the most fun and logical way to do it, and it feels cramped, and it's all three actors trying to find a way into the shot. You know, it was very tight. There was very little room for anyone else but three actors, and so we move in very interesting and funny ways just to even stay in frame. But again, not an answer to your question. My apologies.
My guests are Jason Schwartzman and Wes Anderson. They're co-writers of the new film The Darjeeling Limited, which Schwartzman co-stars in and Anderson directed. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman. And Anderson directed the new film Darjeeling Limited. Jason Schwartzman is one of the stars. They both co-wrote the film with Jason's cousin, Roman Coppola. Jason, I read that Wes Anderson asked all the characters to dress themselves so that they feel more authentic as the characters. So Jason, what did that mean for you and for your character? What did you decide to wear? How did you decide to, you know, dress yourself?
Right. Yeah. Well, perhaps it would be better phrased to say that we as actors were encouraged to get dressed ourselves. The costumes were already decided upon by Wes and by Wes. But we were encouraged, and we just did every morning, put on our own clothes that we wear in the movie, our costumes, at our hotel. And we would all ride to work in our outfits so that right when we got on, and we would do our own hair. You know, for me, that's really just parting it. But I would do my own hair in the morning, put on my suit, and I would go to work in my outfit. And the three actors all would do that, and we wouldn't bring really much on the train. And that's really just, it really helped me. I lived in my suit. And, you know, oftentimes I'd come home after work, and I wouldn't take it off. I loved wearing it, and how the schedule would be is on Sunday night, a little man would knock on my door and hand me my suit, and I'd wear that for 4 days, and then there'd be another knock, and I'd switch it out with another one, and all the microphones were built into the suits. All of it's just to be efficient and to have fun.
Yeah, that might not sound like an unusual thing in general for somebody to dress them, put their clothes on themselves in the morning, but on most movies, you know, the actors go to the set, they go to a trailer, they put on their costume, they sit in a makeup chair, they get their hair done. And that was just on this movie, we didn't do that, which turned out to be so much faster and simpler, and you start to wonder why it was ever done any other way.
Yeah.
Did you want to do it that way for expediency or for getting more interacting?
Well, I wanted to do it that way because I don't like trailers. You know, then you're doing a scene and they go to the trailer and they turn on ESPN, and then you call them and want them to come to play the scene, but the game is almost over, and it's very tough to compete with sports. Isolation. My goal was to try to create a situation where the actors really feel as much as possible like the characters, and they're in it together, and they wanted to do that.
And I was also surprised, you know, movie about brothers and Owen's in it and Luke isn't. They were both in, for instance, The Royal Tenenbaums.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I thought about, I have something else I've been thinking of for Luke, and I thought about Luke for it. In a way, I guess, because they are brothers, I kind of felt like it wouldn't be, that maybe I shouldn't cast them as brothers. And I don't know exactly why I felt that way, but... I always think of Luke for parts, and I've had Luke in lots of movies, and want to do more movies with Luke, and just in the case of this one, the way I saw these characters was different. I just thought this one character was perfect for Adrian, this character was perfect for Jason, and this character was written for Owen.
I have a couple of questions about Owen Wilson, and I don't want to invade his privacy. I don't think these questions will, but if I'm wrong, just stop me.
Okay.
Okay. Everyone, even just seeing the ads or the trailers for the Darjeeling Limited, knows that Owen Wilson's character has his head bandaged, and his head is bandaged and banged up through the movie, and it's because his character has been in a motorcycle accident, and the accident may actually be a suicide. Did you write for this for him, knowing that he had that possibility within him?
Oh, not in any way. I mean, it's, of course not. It's, I don't want to speak for Owen, because I think you'll have an interview with him and he'll just speak for himself much better than I can. But, that character, in you know in I've I, that's the that you know, in the Royal Tenenbaums there's a suicide attempt that's a big part of the movie which Luke Wilson plays, and I think those scenes it comes from my fascination and it's you know something to do with me which I couldn't even begin to explain, but it doesn't have anything to do with Owen.
You're an old friend of Owen Wilson's. You were college friends. You lived together for years. What do you like about working with him as an actor?
Well, you know, Owen is, first of all, Owen, you know, we're best friends, we're peers, but at the same time, in a way, I mean, I sort of think of Owen in some ways as a sort of, I don't want to be too generous to him, but he's a bit mentorish for me. You know, I think we learned a lot. We've learned a lot from each other over the years. But right at the beginning, I think he had certain, he had experience that I hadn't. And, you know, we helped each other with our short stories. That was the first kind of creative work we did together on our own separate stories, but kind of advising each other. And you know, he's a good writer, and he helped me figure some things out for myself. He's, as many people know, I mean, he's very funny. He's one of the funniest guys I've ever met. So I think, you know, and then I cast him in a play when we were in college together. And not because he'd never acted anything before. There was no reason to think that. But he was somebody where he was, you know, captivating to listen to. And I remember my brother came to see the play, and he'd never met Owen, and he loved him. He thought he was, and you know, he responded to Owen like Owen was a movie star.
Do you, like, how many siblings do you each have?
Well, in my family, after a couple marriages and things like that, there's five of us, and I'm second to last.
And is there a pecking order that came from that? Was that significant at all?
In my own family, well, you know, my John and Stephanie, who are the oldest of my siblings, are enough of an age difference where, as I was growing up, they were off to college. So in my household, there was my older brother Matthew, myself, and my younger brother Robert.
Was the sibling dynamic a big issue in your life, where you were age wise with your siblings, Wes?
With me, I also, like Jason, am one of three brothers. I have a younger sister also who's quite a bit younger. So when I was a kid, I was in a house with three brothers. I'm the middle brother, which Jason in a way is too.
I'm the middle brother.
Owen is also middle brother. You know, I think in the 70s they made a big thing out of the middle child. I think you were kind of allowed to feel sorry for yourself. Somehow it was meant to be a really bad luck. I'm very interested in a brother relationship just because it was such a big part of my life. And, you know, my brothers, we, like all brothers, we were fighting all the time when we were kids, but they're the people I'm closest to in the world. It's a dynamic I'm very comfortable with.
Well, I was just going to say, too, the thing I noticed about brothers and the age differences is that you always seem to be missing each other at certain points in your life. One brother wants to be really close with the other one, but because of an age difference, the other one doesn't want to be close to the other. You know, you guys are best friends growing up, and then one goes into seventh grade, and then one stays behind in elementary school, and you know, the younger one still wants to be friends, but then the older one, you know, has got a whole new life. You know, I go to a place now where I can buy soda, and you can't, you know. And then they both get to school, and then one gets a license, so you're constantly being divided by your age, but it's so close. And then, like Wes said, they are the people you're closest to the most, and you love each other so much that allows you to fight in a whole other way. And that's what I think in this movie is interesting, is that when you watch it, though they fight and they bicker, I think it's really nice to see that you can tell they do love each other and they struggle to love each other, and that's what makes it funny and tense, I think. Next question, please.
Wes, I have one more question about Owen Wilson, and again, you're free to answer it or not, but
okay.
I just feel like I should ask it.
Okay.
I I guess I should start this question by expressing my sympathy for you in the sense that someone you're so close to has not, had been
had
so close
episode,
to death and is
yeah.
now, you know, hopefully making a full recovery from that. But have you been in touch with him, and do you think he will be well enough and willing to act again? Do you think you'll be working with him again?
Of course.
Good.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a great deal of misinformation, which I'm not going to clear up, because I think it's better if he just clears it up himself. But people just have to know it. He was never, I think, that close to death is not a very accurate description of what he experienced. And I talk to him all the time. I was with him very recently, and he's following what's going on with our movie. He's just, you know, he's not available to be out. We have to really promote this, and he can't be a part of that right now. But he's, you know, we'll be seeing lots more work from him in the future.
Jason Schwartzman and Wes Anderson, their film The Darjeeling Limited, opens Friday. They'll talk about their film Rushmore in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue featuring the jazz trumpeter Lee Morgan playing confidently and creatively at the age of 18. David Bianculli reviews two new TV shows, Aliens in America and Pushing Daisies. And we continue our interview with Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman. They're co-writers of the new film The Darjeeling Limited, which Schwartzman co-stars in and Anderson directed. They first worked together in the 1998 film Rushmore, which was Schwartzman's first film role. Wes Anderson, you cast Jason Schwartzman in your second film, Rushmore, and Jason, you played somebody in a prep school who gets a crush on one of the teachers and sees Bill Murray, who's this like wealthy father of one of the other kids in the school, as a surrogate father, the kind of father mm-hmm. he kind of wishes he had, who is like mm-hmm. you know, powerful and wealthy, because his own father's a barber. You're terrific in the performance. And
let's
start with how you were cast in the role. Jason, tell us your version, and then we'll ask Wes for his.
How far back would you like me to go?
How many years? I mean, how long is the story?
I think, don't you want to walk in the room and for your audition?
Yep, here you go.
Actually, before you give us your answer, let me say that I'm pretty sure that Davia Nelson, who is known to a lot of public radio listeners
yep.
as one of the Kitchen Sisters, was actually a significant part. well, of the story of how you were cast in Rushmore.
Watch this one.
So I'm at this party in Northern California. Davia Nelson is at the party. I didn't know who Davia was at the time, but I think that she was friends with my family and anyway, got to talking with.
And she was also a casting director in addition to her radio work.
Yes, and she was at this party, and my cousin Sophia actually was talking to her, and they were catching up on each other's lives. And Sophia asked Davia what she was doing, and she said she was casting a film called Rushmore. And Sophia asked what it was about, and Davia said, you know, it's about a high school student who's a playwright and all that. And Sophia said, oh, well, you should, you know, that sounds like my cousin Jason, because I wanted to be, I had written a play and tried to direct a play and all that stuff. And she said, oh, I would love to meet him. Where is he? And she said, he's actually here. And Sophia and Davia beckoned me. They called me over, and I said hello, and I believe I actually had rented a tuxedo with tails, and I had a top hat and a cane, I think, because I was flamboyant and insecure as a teenager. And anyways, Davia told me that she was casting a film called Rushmore, and would I like to audition? She said I might be right for the part or something, and I told her that I was very nice, but I wasn't an actor. I didn't know how to act, and it perhaps could be a waste of everyone's time. After a couple back and forth of that, she sent me a script. She sent the script of Rushmore to my house. It was the first script I ever read, and I must say that I loved it, and I thought it was hysterical, and I never thought I would be in the movie, and I was happy for whoever was going to be the character. Anyways, I called the LA casting office. They told me what the address was. It was on Larchmont. I asked them what to wear. They told me that I should just wear whatever made me comfortable. I realized that I would never be comfortable, so I decided to go all out and put together the outfit that the character wears in the movie, which is khakis and blazer. And I made my own patch with my friend Mike. We Velcroed it onto my suit, and I went to the audition. I skipped school, and I went to the audition, and I walked in, and there was Wes Anderson sitting in the room to read me. And I must say that there was an instant feeling of relaxation that came over my body when I saw Wes being so young and seeming like he could be my friend. He seemed like someone that I could. We instantly started talking, and it was so much fun. And after that, then I auditioned, and then Wes takes it from here.
And well, I would just say that I don't have a lot to add beyond that, because I felt my experience was he walked in the room with this patch velcroed onto his blazer, and I think I kind of knew he was cast within 10 seconds. Like the second as soon as I started talking to him, I thought, oh well, this must be the guy. And then he read the scenes. He read a couple of scenes of the thing. He was perfect. I told him to walk around the block while I read the last auditions I would do, which were the ones the other people waiting in the other room, because I knew once I finished them, I was not going to have to look at anybody else again. Then he came back, and then he read opposite these two brothers who were going to play Bill Murray's twin sons, and he read Bill Murray's part opposite them in their audition, and he was great in Bill Murray's part too.
Let's hear a scene from the film, and this takes place in Jason Schwartzman is in the passenger seat of the back seat of Bill Murray's car. And remember, Bill Murray is this kind of would-be surrogate father in this. It's the father he wishes he had. But Schwartzman has just found out that Bill Murray is having an affair with the teacher at the prep school, the teacher that Schwartzman is in love with. So he's really upset at Bill Murray having this affair. And so here he is. Here's Jason Schwartzman in the car expressing his anger to Bill Murray.
How was she, Herman?
Jesus Christ.
Was she good? I bet she was. Although I wouldn't know because I never s***ed her. Going skinny to being willing to take a nap. Are you comfortable, Max? I'll just be out back nude getting s***ups from the woman you love.
We never went skinny dipping.
Sure you didn't. And next you're going to tell me you didn't just walk out of our house at 2:00 in the morning.
I'm in love with her.
Well, I was in love with her first. And all that crap about, I don't think she's that great. I don't think she's right for you, Max. That was all bullshit, wasn't it? Do you think she's in love with you?
I don't know.
Well, I guarantee you she's not. and she never will be.
That's Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray in a scene from Rushmore. My guests are Jason Schwartzman and Wes Anderson, who directed that film and the new film Darjeeling Limited. So Wes Anderson, directing somebody as eccentric as Bill Murray with somebody as new to acting as Jason Schwartzman, was that difficult to balance?
No, you know, we had a great time making that movie. Jason and I rehearsed for some months before the movie, so we knew each other well, and he knew his character very well, and so we were very comfortable with each other. Bill, I had met once, and he arrived the day before we set to work. We got to know Bill then, and then later, I think I've done four movies with Bill Murray now. There was just a short process of us kind of figuring out who we were, you know, how we were going to interact, what we thought of each other, mm-hmm. and once that occurred, I think we were kind of set to work together for years.
Jason Schwartzman, did Bill Murray give you any advice? Because he was the pro, you were the newcomer.
I will give you some advice that Bill gave to me one night to have like a kind of a toast, I suppose, or a kickoff friendship working together toast. We went down to the hotel bar after dinner, and Bill ordered 3 Fernet Brancas, which was a bitter drink that I'd never heard of before, probably because it's a strange drink and also because I was 17. And then we had these 3 Fernet Brancas, and Bill said, "This is good to drink because it digests it from the top." And I never forgot that one.
Digest it from the top.
That's what he said, digest it from the top, baby.
What does that mean?
I think it means like you it's after you, you know, it's a digestif.
Yeah.
Yeah, so after you've eaten, it helps. It's like medicine. It tastes like medicine. It works like medicine.
Yeah.
It digests it from the, it helps you digest it, but from the top.
Yeah. And then he also gave me a piece of advice that I never have really understood, which I said, "How do you know, Bill, when you're in your character?" You know, and he said, "How much do you weigh?" And I said, "I don't know, 140 pounds. He said, "Do you feel 140 pounds in your feet?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "When you do, then you'll know."
Wow, bad, that's right? Elliptical.
Yeah, sure is.
Digest it from the top and feel it in your feet.
That's right.
Yeah, well, how helpful was that?
Quite. I think about it a lot, actually, when I'm working.
My guests are actor and writer Jason Schwartzman and director and screenwriter Wes Anderson. They've worked together on the new film, The Darjeeling Limited, and the 1998 film Rushmore. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are actor and writer Jason Schwartzman and director and screenwriter Wes Anderson. They've worked together on the new film, The Darjeeling Limited, and the 1998 film Rushmore. Jason, how much did you grow up on movie sets? You know, your mother is Talia Shire, who was, mm-hmm. she was the Godfather's daughter, Michael Corleone's sister in The Godfather, Rocky's girlfriend. I mean, so did you grow up around movie sets?
Rocky's wife.
Well, I'm
just kidding. But to be honest, my memories are I have very little memories of growing up on movie sets. It felt like my mom was around a lot when I was growing up. I don't think she worked as much when my younger brother and I were born. So of course I went a couple times, I think, to the set of Rocky III, maybe, and we did go to Italy for The Godfather III, but not for long periods of time. I wasn't a kid who really grew up on movie sets at all. I did not have that kind of life. My mom was kept that away from us.
Wasn't there a BMX movie or something that you were on a lot?
Oh, yeah. I did. There was a movie that my father produced and my mom was in called Rad that was a BMX biking movie that I actually really love, and that I got to hang around a lot on. But I don't have very many memories. There, I had a very un-Hollywood childhood as far as I was concerned.
So, you know, so many of us first encountered you from Rushmore. Briefly, what were you like in high school?
I was a B-plus student, and my personal feeling was that I felt kind of alienated, or that girls, I seemed to be like the girls' best friend. I didn't ever seem to be the one they wanted. They always like wanted my friends, and I was the go-between, giving them messages. But I personally was down on myself about like how I was doing with girls. I just was pretty insecure as a high school student, probably.
You were a high school rock star. What are you talking about?
Okay, you want my high school years. I had a really good time in high school.
I
was very popular, straight A student. I was a jock, lead guitar player in the jazz band. I would say that my time in high school, I had great friends and I got along pretty well with everybody. And mostly I just tried to get good grades and talk, have confidence to talk to girls and stuff. I was really consumed, I think, with that kind of stuff.
You were in a band.
I'm trying to do all right.
You were in a band in high school or after?
In high school, yeah. We played my eighth grade graduation. That was our first show.
Wow.
Yeah,
my take on what you were like in high school is I remember we went over to shoot in a scene with a classroom full of kids who you had never met when we were doing Rushmore. Yep. And basically every syllable that Jason uttered, the entire classroom started laughing at. They were immediately all completely taken with you. I think that might be a more accurate description of what you were like in high school from the point of view of somebody actually seeing you or meeting you.
Right.
Well, it's been great to talk to both of you. Good luck with the new movie. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Sorry, Wes, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the new film, The Darjeeling Limited. Jason Schwartzman co-wrote it and co-stars in it. It opens Friday. Schwartzman also has a new CD of his songs called Coconut Records. The fall TV season is officially in its second week on the broadcast networks. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, says his two favorite new shows of the season arrive this week, one tonight, the other on Wednesday.
Most of the new shows this season are trying and failing to recapture the magic of recent hits. There are lots of romantic comedies with large ensembles, trying to be either Desperate Housewives or Grey's Anatomy. One of them, ABC's Big Shots, which premiered last week, even tries to be an all-male Sex and the City with four attractive guys sitting around talking. They're all instantly forgettable, so let's forget about them and move on. The other big batch of wannabes features new shows that are trying to be like either Lost or Heroes. Here, the shows with the lighter touch, specifically Chuck and Reaper, come off the best and are fun to watch. But their plots are so similar they could almost swap casts or coexist in the same series. They're both about ordinary slacker guys with loyal, funny best friends and low self-esteem who work in crummy sales jobs but suddenly are hit with a life-changing experience. One has tons of top-secret spy knowledge zapped into his brain. The other becomes the reluctant employee of the devil. They're enjoyable, but they're not unique, not even from each other. But my two favorite shows of the year, they're defiantly different. Tonight on the CW network, you can find it if you look hard enough, is the premiere of the sitcom Aliens in America. Wednesday on ABC is the premiere of a new comedy drama, Pushing Daisies, which has the most original series concept in years. Aliens first. Like Everybody Hates Chris, which it follows, Aliens in America is told from a teenager's point of view. Dan Bird stars as Justin Tolchuk, a 16-year-old from Wisconsin whose first day of high school goes so badly, his parents decide to boost his popularity by sponsoring an exchange student. They're expecting some blonde Nordic hunk like the one on the cover of the guidance department brochure. What they get, instead, is Raja, a Muslim exchange student from Pakistan. He's perfectly played by Adhir Kalan. And if Justin thought his first day of class went badly, listen to Raja's.
Class, today I'm going to put aside our lesson because we have a special guest. For 1 year, we will be in the presence of a real live Pakistani who practices Muslimism. That means we have the opportunity to learn about his culture and he about ours. So let's begin a dialogue. Raja, you are so different from us. How does that feel?
I am not sure I understand.
Mm-hmm. Think about it. How does everyone else feel about Raja and his differences? Yes, Stephanie.
Well, I guess I feel angry because his people blew up the buildings in New York.
Oh, that's good.
But that is not true.
Okay, Raja, in America, you have to wait until you're called on and I'd appreciate a raised hand.
Just to have a Muslim character at the center of a comedy is daring right now. To have him be the most sympathetic one in the show, that's almost subversive. But the lesson of tolerance, delivered so lightly and wittily that it doesn't even seem like a lesson, is less important here than the fact that Aliens in America, pure and simple, is a very funny show. Pushing Daisies, which premieres Wednesday, is a very weird show. It's so strange, it's difficult to describe. And my fear is, the more I try to describe it, the stupider I make it sound. A lot of it is visual. Imagine a modern-day fable that takes place in a neighborhood with the oversaturated colors of Oz. So you'll just have to trust me until you see for yourself. But please, do see for yourself. Lots of talented people are involved with this show. The director of the pilot of Pushing Daisies is Barry Sonnenfeld, of the Addams Family and Men in Black films. The creator is Brian Fuller, who made Dead Like Me and Wonderfalls. The supporting cast includes Swoozy Kurtz, Ellen Green, and Kristen Chenoweth. The narrator is Jim Dale, who records the books on tape versions of the Harry Potter novels. And the stars are Lee Pace and Anna Friel, who play childhood sweethearts reunited after many years apart. He's Ned, she's nicknamed Chuck, and the only problem is, when they reunite at a funeral home, she's already dead. But that's just the start of this unique love story, because Ned has the power to raise the dead. Here's where I worry about losing people. And it gets even weirder, because Ned's powers come with some very specific rules. Ned touches something dead once, it comes back to life. He touches it again, it dies forever. He lets it live more than a minute, and something else around him dies.
Chuck, wait!
Who are you?
Do you remember the little boy who lived next door to you when your dad died?
Ned? Oh my God, hey, how are you?
Good, you look great. Do you know what's happening right now?
I had the strangest dream. I was being strangled to death with a plastic sack.
You were strangled to death with a plastic sack. That's probably an odd thing to hear, but I wasn't quite sure how to sugarcoat it.
Oh.
You only have a minute, less.
What can I do in less than a minute?
You can tell me who killed you, so, you know, justice can be served.
Well, that's really sweet, but I don't know who killed me. I went to go get ice, and I dropped my room key in the ice maker, and as I was thinking, that was dumb.
As she was thinking that was dumb, Chuck was strangled to death with a plastic sack.
And then you touched my cheek.
What's going on here?
Just a second.
Is my time up?
I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for calling me Chuck. Do you know no one's called me Chuck since you?
I used to. When I lived next door to you, I had a you were my first kiss.
Yeah? You were my first kiss, too. You want to be my last kiss? First and last? Or is that weird?
That's not weird. It's symmetrical.
So that's the setup. If Ned kisses her, she's dead forever. If he lets her live, and it wouldn't be much of a series if he didn't, he can never kiss her or touch her again without killing her. It's the perfect solution to the moonlighting problem of will they or won't they. They can't. But can true love exist without physical contact? That's what Pushing Daisies sets out to explore, along with questions about life and death and what makes a really good pie. In television, what makes a really good show, most of the time, is originality. Pushing Daisies, like Aliens in America, serves up originality in generous, yummy slices. Please try both. On this year's primetime menu of new shows, they're the only specials of the day that are truly special.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue featuring trumpeter Lee Morgan at the age of 18. This is Fresh Air. Jazz trumpeter Lee Morgan played in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers for 3 years, starting in 1958. He had a jukebox hit in the mid-60s with The Sidewinder, a jazz tune with a rockish boogaloo beat. In 1972, he was fatally shot outside a New York nightclub. But before all that, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Morgan was a precocious teenager who played trumpet ridiculously well. Kevin reviews a reissue of music Morgan recorded at age 18.
That's Benny Golson's jazz standard Whisper Knot, recorded by Lee Morgan in December of 1956. Back then it was a brand new tune, but Morgan took a solo so assured and creative, he might have been playing it for years. Showing that when you play the trumpet using a metal Harmon mute, you don't have to sound like Miles Davis. Morgan was a protege of Dizzy Gillespie and a great admirer of Clifford Brown, but this teenager already had something of his own to say. Morgan's lines are supple and lyrical, his rhythms dart this way and that, and I love that tuneful little quote from Pop Goes the Weasel. Whisper Not comes from the new reissue, Lee Morgan Volume 2, Sextet, from Blue Note. It's one more reminder what a golden age for jazz the 1950s was. Saxophonist Hank Mobley on Benny Golson's Latin Hangover. Golson wrote 4 of the 6 pieces on this album, when he was just blossoming as a writer of catchy melodies that improvisers love to dig into. The sextet's pianist is Horace Silver, so one great jazz composer interprets another. Paul Chambers is on bass, Charlie Persips on drums, and little-known Kenny Rogers gets a nice beefy sound on alto sax. But this date really belongs to the leader. Even in a music blessed with trumpet prodigies, Lee Morgan was extra special. His confidence and ability to improvise striking phrases and string them into flowing statements would be extraordinary even if he hadn't been 18 and still growing. Morgan began recording only a month before this 1956 date, but in the intervening 30 days, he'd done three Hank Mobley sessions and cut a live album with Dizzy Gillespie's big band. 4 months later, he recorded another sextet date, just back out as Lee Morgan Volume 3. There, Benny Golson not only wrote the tunes, including a rapturous I Remember Clifford, but also plays excellent tenor saxophone. Though I'm a major Golson fan, I like Morgan's blend with the gruff Hank Mobley here even better. Still, it is a close call, and either way, you get lots of Lee Morgan in the 1950s. It doesn't get much better than that.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Husbandry, Sex, Love, and Dirty Laundry, Inside the Minds of Married Men by Stephen Fried. From Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
According to an article in the current edition of The New Yorker by Seymour Hersh, the Bush administration has redrawn its longstanding plans for a possible attack on Iran and changed its rationale for confronting Iran. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Seymour Hersh. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.